If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In their battle to control the citizens of East Germany, the Ministry for State Security employed a variety of weapons. Among them, rather surprisingly, was poetry. And in his new book, The Stasi Poetry Circle, journalist Philip Alterman tells the story of how the Stasi tried to instruct its agents to write better poems and win the Cold War through creative writing. Rob Attar caught up with Philip recently to find out more about this curious chapter in the history of the GDR.
Philip, I wonder if we could begin by talking about ice cream, because in the first page of your book, one of the characters in your story is thinking about different flavours of ice cream. And I felt that that really added colour to a country that I think we often picture in various shades of grey. So I wondered if this was quite a deliberate metaphor for the story that you're telling in this book and showing a different side to the GDR.
Well, thank you for your interest in ice cream. I think the reason why I started by zooming in on that detail was so that the book is a piece of historical research, but while a lot of the information I got was from files and also from history books and as well as fiction and poetry, a large part of the book is based on interviews with people who were in the Stasi, as well as people who are victims of the Stasi. And I wanted to write it's not a biography, it's a group biography in a way. You had a lot of people who gathered on a regular basis in a room. And I wanted to sort of also paint a picture of who these characters were and get a bit beyond the idea that the Stasi were sort of these grey men in anoraks and sort of try and paint a picture of this incredibly inhumane, oppressive machine that was East Germany's secret police, that also made you realize that there were people behind it, and that the evil that the Stasi created was at times sort of quite banal. I mean, that's the sort of paradox of history. It's by no means an excuse for what the Stasi did, but it's the reality that there was something at times, banal, farcical, absurd about what these people did. So one of the first person I managed to track down from this circle in this Stasi was a guy called Jürgen Polinske, who I think over 5 years I interviewed about at least five times at length. At the time, he worked as a librarian in central Berlin, not far from where my office is for my Guardian office in central Berlin. And so after our first interview, one winter, I just bumped into him at Friedrichstrasse station. And there's an ice cream parlor inside the station. And it was really cold. I was wearing gloves. And he was just standing there sort of dreaming, walking and with an ice cream. And now he told me, it's one of my special skills, he said, is that I love eating ice cream in the winter. People always eat ice cream in the summer, but I love eating ice cream in the winter. And I just thought that was somehow got at this character who, I didn't write this in the book, but he reminded me a bit of Baloo the Bear or something. There was something sort of jolly about him. And that seemed so at odds with a lot of what the Stasi did. Again, I'm not saying the Stasi was jolly, but there was something that characters like that were part of it that interested me. So I, and at the same time, the ice cream in the Cold War seemed to somehow fitting introduction. So in the next interview, I got him to tell me a little bit more about his obsession with ice cream and the types of ice cream you could get in East Germany, the fact that you couldn't really get gelato of the type that maybe we know from Italy or also from West Germany, but there was a particular Moscow style ice cream that he really loved, which was vanilla ice cream with a between two wafers of waffle. So that's how the introduction, the opening scene of the book came about.
And you've alluded to this a couple of times in that last answer, this idea of the fact that on the one hand these people were part of an organization that was quite inhumane and devastated the lives of many East Germans, but on the other hand you're showing a kind of cultural softer side perhaps to the Stasi. I wonder how difficult a balance that was to strike when you're writing the book, and even when you're meeting these people.
Yeah, it's a really difficult balance to strike, because the risk is if you only paint the human side, that you then provide a platform for them to redeem themselves. And they did, by their membership for the work that they did, the Stasi, they were cogs in a machine that oppressed people and devastated thousands of lives. So I tried to, by the very subject matter, I wanted to get beyond the idea of the Stasi as this completely ruthless machine. That also, you know, I wanted to sort of explore the inefficiencies and contradictions it had, and in a way to also undermine the image of itself it had that was projected as this glamorous detective agency. So there's a as I allude to or write about in the book, there was a whole PR exercise that the Stasi embarked on in the 70s in order to sort of paint itself as a very glamorous organization, where they created a sort of spin, or like, you know, they tried to copy James Bond and created an East German James Bond series. Das unsichtbare Visier, or the invisible crosshair, or invisible visor, however you want to translate it, which painted life in the Stasi as something very glamorous, which involved dashing across countries, stopping wars, agents of peace, always on alert, who were bedding beautiful women, as well as undermining the forces of empire as they saw it. Well, that was how they liked to see themselves, perhaps, or they wanted to, the East German population, to see themselves, but in reality, it was a lot more mundane, and there was a lot of file keeping. I mean, there was a lot of just sort of logging details, and I think a lot of the time it was just brain-numbingly dull for a lot of them. I think what I was interested in more and more is that there was the idea that there was a sort of generational conflict, even within the Stasi. That originally the Stasi had, you know, modelled itself on the Cheka, on the Bolshevist secret police, and it had tried to recruit its employees from working class backgrounds. It wanted its agents to be uneducated in a way. It thought that, you know, it wouldn't want clever people with university degrees. It wanted people who fought class war efficiently. But then the Stasi was also, you know, constantly expanding. So it increased its machine over the years, and it ran out of sort of working class people to recruit, and also because it was incredibly paranoid about it wanted to control the people who worked for it. So a lot of the people who were recruited later on were the sons, or in some cases daughters of officers in the Stasi. And the recruitment files always say that, you know, these were, I mean, originally it said, you know, they were loyal as a member of the working class, and then it sort of changed to a loyal defender of the working class, because effectively these people weren't working class anymore. They were already actually quite privileged because of the privileges that the state had granted them. Because of their roles, they went to special schools. They had access to all sorts of amenities in East German life that the general population didn't have. So that's sort of, I think, one of the balances to strike. And the other balances, I think, is because I was interested in this story of something that was going on with the Stasi, I felt there's a risk that, you know, I felt I needed to also look at the victims of this at times evilly banal system. So that's why a couple of the chapters in the book also try to tell the stories of people who ran up against the system and, you know, whose lives were ruined by them in a way that is still very tangible today.
So for those of our listeners who may not know much about how the Stasi operated, what could the Stasi do to someone that they deemed to be an enemy or a potential enemy?
There's an example in the book of a young woman. I mean, she wasn't a woman at the time that she came onto the Stasi's radar. She was a student at school. She was a teenager. She was a teenager who wrote poetry, and poetry which was sort of angry, but in a way that teenagers often are. There was nothing at all threatening to a normal state. And yet the Stasi became more and more interested in her, partly just because the way it worked, someone who brushed up against the system was sort of hauled in and analyzed in more and more detail until eventually the Stasi convinced itself that this was a threat to the state. So, you know, she wrote sort of angry poetry which had directed anger at the regime and the Socialist Unity Party that was the de facto single party of East Germany. She also for a while didn't really want to work, which was something that East Germany hadn't really you know, it was difficult in a worker state. She just wanted to be a hitchhiker, and she listened to blues. There was a sort of growing scene of, I mean, effectively hippies, people who grew their hair long and went hitchhiking, went to blues festivals around East Germany. And she wrote, she wrote a lot. And so how does the state deal with someone like her? I mean, in her case, you know, that it prevented her from getting a job. I mean, when she did want to get a job, I think her dream was to become a librarian or a bookseller. And she had an apprenticeship, and the Stasi then just cancelled that. And under the sort of fake pretext that, you know, it was passed down from the authorities to the people who'd guaranteed an apprenticeship to her. So her career was just curtailed. I mean, that's something that, you know, is an ongoing problem now, because it's quite hard to prove that people who basically were stopped from ever completing an apprenticeship as a result are still not earning a lot of money. It's very hard now for them to prove that to the state nowadays and say, look, you know, I mean, some of them deserve compensation and state support because they were stopped from ever sort of fulfilling their potential. And that's a very live debate going on in Germany still at the moment, because often it's very, very hard to prove that. People who were... And so, I mean, then there's the next level of people who were, sort of became, in a way, active dissidents who did want to take on the state and continue down their path in spite of intimidation. And there, the Stasi could be incredibly ruthless. I mean, there's this this term that was. That was used internally, which is Zersetzung, which, I mean, one way to translate it, I think, would be biodegradation or something like this. It's a sort of biological term, but it just means essentially, I mean, maybe nowadays we would call it gaslighting. I mean, it's a way to unsettle them and to corrode trust in all the people they had around them. And that meant that the Stasi, in the case of one of the writers that I portray in the book, that they, I mean, in some cases confirmed, in some cases likely, that the Stasi recruited his mother, his ex-wife, and possibly, I mean, certainly some friends as unofficial collaborators. That was caused a psychological trauma and a sort of fundamental distrust in human relationships, and that, you know, there were more sort of just there were other forms of chicanery that they employed, which is like, you know, ringing the doorbell at night. They would you know, just bombard them with post that just sort of that wasn't for them, but you know, phone calls in the middle of the night, and it's just a sort of a permanent form of psychological warfare. Sometimes these people were just beaten up. Those who were subject to that kind of treatment are still, you know, carry the scars of that today.
So actually, earlier in that answer, you talked about how a girl was writing poetry and that saw her falling foul of the Stasi. So when did the Stasi actually then become interested in creating their own poetry, which is the central story in your book?
Mm-hmm. To answer that question, I sort of have to take a little bit of a sort of step back. And I think this is something that when I embarked on this project for this book, I myself wasn't really that aware of. It's fair to say that literature meant quite a lot to the German Democratic Republic, as it called itself. It had a sort of founding myth, which had a lot to do with being a very literary state. A lot of the people who shaped East Germany in its early years were poets or writers or playwrights who'd been in exile from the Nazis and were given political posts. A lot of them were expressionist poets, or at least sort of three significant figures were, who renounced expressionism but sort of still had a sort of certain zeal or energy, perhaps, that they projected into this new state. And they had an idea that literature would not just be entertainment, it would not just be a distraction from everyday life. It would have an equal standing to politics. It would shape the mentality of this nation. Now, that's quite vague. I mean, it's certainly very utopian. And some of these cultural founding fathers of East Germany wrote down are truly esoteric and a bit crazy. But it did also result in some programs that the state initiated. And one of them is known as the Bitterfelder Weg, which was started in 1963, the Bitterfeld Path. It's named after the town of Bitterfeld, where there was a conference where the East German state tried to basically come up with ways to bridge the gulf between the working classes and the intelligentsia. That it wanted to, its ideal citizens that it wanted to create were workers who wrote and writers who worked. So in practice, that meant that lots of branches of industry had their own writing circles. So, and that meant that sometimes quite established writers were put into factories for a certain amount of time where they worked, but then also taught the workers how to write. And in some cases, this produced some quite interesting literature. There's a novel and a film, which, you know, in the film is certainly one of the most interesting films to emerge from East Germany, Die Spur der Steine, The Path of the Stones, which is about, it's a sort of workplace drama, but it's really interesting. And this was the novel that it's based on was written in one of those circles, and there are several other examples. So the Stasi thought, why shouldn't we have our own circle? So that, in a way, that's quite, maybe that's the naive explanation. It's like, you know, why not have every part of East German working life had sort of writing circles? Why shouldn't the Stasi have one? And it set something up sporadically in the 60s that was continued throughout the 70s, but in a quite half-hearted way, and sometimes a quite comical way, because the poems that sort of were produced in those circles were, I mean, they're just quite funny. I mean, they're sort of is love poetry, a lot of it, and it sometimes mixes up the sort of language of Marxism and romance in unexpected ways, where there's one poem which is essentially about a teenager who's in love, and he says, I'm only a soldier in love, but I dream of being promoted to being your lance corporal, and then he says, but my love for you is mine, just mine, and I hope it can never be collectivized or nationalized, which is sort of at odds a bit with what you expect from a state that values collective property over private property. It's an irregular meetup of people in the Stasi for a good decade and a half, and then something happens in around 1982, where suddenly the Stasi starts taking this program a lot more seriously, and that's in a way where the story gets interesting, or got interesting for me, because the Stasi drafted in a professional poet. I mean, someone who was an award-winning, very highly respected, well-reviewed, widely published poet to come in to a heavily fortified compound in East Berlin once a month for 2 hours and teach a room full of border guards, propaganda officers, young people working in the archive department. He teaches them how to write verse properly and it gives some structure to this poetry circle. And that's when I was sort of wondering whether maybe there was more to it than just a sort of naive explanation, you know, if they were taking it so seriously, what was the purpose of this circle?
And so could I ask you, what do you think the purpose was of taking this poetry more seriously and this incredible idea of, like you say, these a poet coming to this heavily fortified building to teach the state security apparatus about, you know, rhyming? That's
This is where the banal meets the more sinister, or, you know, where it's something can be absurd but not necessarily funny. I think there's sort of at least two explanations. I have to say that this was never fully put down on paper. It's my explanation for why they professionalized the circle is based on interviews and some guesswork from archive material that I found. But I think I already alluded to earlier to the fact that the Stasi had grown massively and there was a new generation that had come in. So how does the Stasi keep watch on itself? It wasn't, you know, senior officers weren't meant to be spied on by itself in the Stasi, but it wanted to exercise some form of control. And so in practice, you know, one of the simple ways it achieved that was by making sure that Stasi officers always worked in rooms of two. They often didn't have rarely had their own offices, so that could make sure that, you know, that someone was keeping, comrade was keeping watch on comrade. But then there was something suspicious about some people who were the quiet ones, who didn't always say out loud what they thought. And that was certainly how the poetry circles in other branches of industry, or even in everyday life in East Germany, often operated. That's a provable fact that very frequently poetry circles were run by people who were also informants. The woman whose story I told earlier, who was a woman who wanted to write poetry, she ended up in several poetry circles across East Germany, Northeast Germany, where it emerged later that the person who'd been the poet who was her confidant, a very seemingly trustworthy figure, was in fact passing everything on to the Stasi, everything she wrote. Poetry is often confessional. You know, it's something we express our innermost doubts, desires, yearnings. And so having a poem is a sort of x-ray of the soul to an extent that the Stasi could get a hold of in that way. So it emerges that the poet who is drafted in by the Stasi to teach the spies to write poetry ended up spying on the spies as they start writing poetry. So he produced regular reports on their poems that he passed on to a senior handler at the Stasi to alert them to thoughts that these people had that weren't in compliance with the state's ideology, or they were suspicious because they had doubts about whether about a nuclear war, and whether perhaps Marxism would also be to blame for a nuclear war, or they have questionable loyalty to the working class. All this emerges. So in a way, the cynical expression is that poetry could become a sort of bugging device on the things that people don't say out loud. That's how, in practice, this Stasi poetry functioned. There's another level that, as well as having a paranoia about itself, the Stasi or the East German state had a growing paranoia about writers and about poets and intellectuals, which became a sort of culture war in the from the late 70s until the eventual demise of East Germany. Why was that? Now, East Germany, its authority to an extent rested on the governing party claiming that it could read Marx and maybe Lenin in the right way. It had the authority on what these writings meant and how it would be applied to run the state. So when you had these laterally thinking creatives who suddenly could read something as intellectually challenging as the writings of Karl Marx in a different way and come up with different conclusions, that was very problematic and something that that the state was scared of in a way that is unexpected. It seemed to be truly worried about literary dissidents, to the extent that the Stasi had a sort of think tank which produced in the early 80s produced reports that are truly absurd in that they argue or warn the Stasi that writers or creative writers employ a means of camouflaging their true thoughts. The suspect techniques it lists are essentially just standard devices of creative writing, analogy, metaphor, anything that disguises anything and doesn't state anything, your thoughts clearly, which is the definition really of creative writing or of poetry, that in itself became a suspect activity. So this Stasi poetry circle also became, in at least one instance, became a way to try and recruit people like that and bring young people who could understand poetry and had contacts in the world of poetry into the fold, and then send them out and gather information. In the one instance that of the one person that I from this circle who was effectively sort of groomed as an informant like that, it didn't quite work out because he was very torn between wanting to be a spy and wanting to be a poet. And eventually he came down on the side of poetry. But that was certainly, in this one instance, an attempt. That was the function of the circle in that case.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Sometimes you are strong and sometimes weak. Sometimes you are tired and sometimes awake. Sometimes you are brave and don't know no harm. Sometimes a single word has the strength to disarm. Sometimes the hottest summer day leaves you cold. Sometimes you grasp a spider's web for hold. And yet you carry on and pretend that you are happy inside and always content.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And could you paint us a picture of one of the circle's meetings? What would actually happen at one of their gatherings?
So there used to be a paramilitary compound in East Berlin in a district called Adlershof, which, if you've ever come into the old airport, Berlin-Schönefeld, the overground line passes that. It's now a sort of modern technology park. It's actually very close to where Angela Merkel used to do her scientific research before she was a politician, when she was just a young scientist in East Germany. So, but there was this paramilitary compound called Regiment Felix Dzerzhinsky, named after the founder of the Cheka. And in this compound, this circle met once a month, from 1982 until the collapse of East Germany, the fall of the wall, once a month for 2 hours. And the Stasi employees were those who attended. Some of them attended in uniform. Some of them, the more senior officers, could come in casual wear. They were encouraged to bring along poems and read them out. And then there would be some feedback, very politely, formally done by Uwe Berger, who was the poet who was had been brought to draft it in. And he would give them some feedback on the mostly on the sort of formal technical aspects of a poem, how to write a good cross rhyme, how to what meter was, that some maybe sometimes rhyme wasn't everything. And then he sort of tried to usher them a bit towards his idea of what a good political poem was as well. He was very much someone who believed that poetry could serve a political function. So in a way, he was certainly straying from this, if this was a founding vision of East Germany, that maybe they would have a poet, art and politics would have an equal standing. He certainly felt that poetry had to be a vehicle for ideology. There was a catchphrase that sort of echoed around through East German history, even though it was coined before the Second World War, by a playwright called Friedrich Wolf, who later became East Germany's ambassador to Poland. He said that Kunst ist eine Waffe, art is a weapon. And it's the job of the artist to forge this weapon and the working classes have to pick it up.
Now, I wonder if you could give us a flavour of some of the poetry that they produced. Would you mind reading one or two of their poems?
Sure. Okay, I'll read two poems. One which is an example, perhaps, of trying to inject the sometimes mundane everyday of a Stasi operative with some glamour, and which is an example of the idea that poetry could work as a sort of rallying call, could rouse emotion, could instill some passion in the people and keep their morale up. But I think there's at the same time something, yeah, slightly ironic about the subject matter that is actually being written about. The poem is called Night Shift. Between night and morning, a radio call. Quickly, frenzy. Phones ringing. Teletype writers chattering. Tired yawns, but excited concentration. Precise research through accurately filed matter. Information to the comrades. Quiet pride. Mission accomplished in the struggle for peace. And the other poem that I'd like to read is a poem which I found in the Stasi records archive. The Stasi Poetry Circle published, there are four anthologies that were published, three that were actually printed, four that were another one that was sort of sent to the printer, but never was actually printed because by then East Germany had ceased to exist. But in the archive, there are also other poems that were produced clearly in this circle, but were deemed to be a suspect or perhaps not, seemed to voice questions or doubt or fears that weren't considered appropriate for the secret police. And I think, therefore, get very interesting. This poem, from what I could gather, was written really in the last few years of East Germany as the Soviet bloc, Russia, Poland, Hungary were embarking on a reformist course, there was political change, economic change, and everything seemed to speed up, which East Germany tried to resist much more than other Soviet satellite states. At the same time, even the people in the Stasi clearly found these changes dizzying and disconcerting and slightly terrifying. And I think this poem speaks of that, of those fears that they weren't really allowed to speak in public. The poem is called Stop Going Around in Circles. Don't get yourself in a spin. Tender words need whispering. Speak up if you don't want to be heard, but never speak up to hurt. And when no hope is in sight, you can knock on my door late at night. Sometimes you are strong and sometimes weak. Sometimes you are tired and sometimes awake. Sometimes you are brave and don't know no harm. Sometimes a single word has the strength to disarm. Sometimes the hottest summer day leaves you cold. Sometimes you grasp a spider's web for hold. And yet you carry on and pretend that you are happy inside and always content. I should say that these were my translations of the original German and thus imperfect.
Well, thank you so much for reading those for us. I mean, they are really fascinating insight, into the psyche of some of these members of the Stasi. I mean, so you're a writer yourself. I don't know how much you're a poet, but what could you say about the quality of these poems? I mean, is this good poetry? Is it doggerel? How would you describe it?
I mean, I'm not a poet. I'm a journalist. This book is, it's a journalistic work, but I guess there's some elements, of narrative elements. But I'm certainly, I'm not a poet. I've never held any aspiration to be a poet. I studied English and German literature at university before I became a journalist. And so I have a sort of, an interest in poetry still from that. And I didn't want to, part of what I thought was a challenge was to write a book about unknown poets whose poetry in some cases really wasn't very good. Sometimes it's comically bad. That's fair to say. In some cases, I think it's interesting. There were a couple of people in this circle who, one of the questions: what is good poetry anyway? Is it technically accomplished? Does it tick the boxes of formal requirements, or is it essentially just is good poetry a way to pile interesting ideas in an oblique, roundabout way into a couple of lines? Are there some interesting contradictions, interesting metaphors in there? I think one idea that I clung onto is that good poetry is sort of the ability to hold two ideas in your head at the same time. And I think on that metric, some of them are interesting poems and enjoyable.
Would I be right to assume that the Stasi poetry circle dissolved or was ended with the fall of the GDR itself?
Everyone knows about the fall of the Berlin Wall. It didn't mean that the Stasi immediately ceased to exist the next day. So the Stasi continued to exist in some form until at least early 1990. There was a significant moment in January 1990 when they were processed outside the Stasi headquarters, where a large part of the archive was also held, which was eventually led to people storming the building. And one of the people I interviewed for this book was inside the building that the protesters stormed, and wrote down he tried to write a memoir, which was never published, but he let me read his account. And there's a sort of poignant moment for the Stasi Poetry Circle where they had a little showcase at the bottom of one of the staircases with, artistic works created by Stasi operatives, including one of the booklets, and that was smashed and defaced. So the justifiable anger resulted in the squashing of this circle symbolically. Some of the Stasi men continued to write poetry, and some of them, they're still, one of them still attends poetry circles, which are not Stasi affiliated, but literally in the same part of East Berlin. Some of them have given up entirely, the circle as such doesn't exist anymore.
And on a slightly different note, I know that you said earlier, before we started the interview, that you yourself grew up in West Germany, and I realise you'd have been quite young at the time, but I wonder what views you had of the GDR living on the other side of the wall, so to speak.
Mm. Yeah, so I was born in Hamburg in 1981. And so I was eight when the Berlin Wall fell. So, I remember, I think my parents woke me up in the middle of the night I turned over and fell asleep again. I mean, it really didn't mean anything to me at the time. Turned out we had some distant relatives that over the coming years we visited once. I think there was a woman who had come over from East Berlin that my mother met in Hamburg on the subway and who needed some shelter. And we let her stay with us for a couple of days. That was sort of my first experience. But really, I was too young to think of it in broader abstract or political terms. It was certainly, the impression that I had was probably the standard impression that anyone in Western Europe has of the Eastern Bloc, which is, it's grey and it looks downcast, it looks depressing. That's the sort of idea. So, and I think that's, we all know those pictures of the fall of the wall. We know the films of East Germany as this sort of concrete, drab landscape. And I think that's what I found interesting in a way to sort of try and understand a little bit what the founding myths of East Germany were, or what came before. And that's something I really didn't know from attending a school in Germany. And I really wasn't, I studied German literature, but really there was very little East German literature I read. There are just a couple of works that made it into the West German syllabus, but a lot of it is forgotten. I mean, nowadays, I think the novelists who win prizes are East German and they write about East Germany, but it's retrospective. It's written after the war. So there's a lot of cultural heritage that really, as a West German or as a reunified German, even though you don't know anything about. And that's what I found really interesting to try and attempt to get my head around what the value judgments were, what the ideals were, and what the contradictions were.
That was Philip Alterman. The Stasi Poetry Circle is out now, published by Faber and Faber. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.